Salmon is a huge occupation and preoccupation for a lot of Alaskans. Whether you run a commercial fishing operation, catch salmon for subsistence, to stretch your grocery budget, or you're a guide helping visitors enjoy the thrill of the catch, the pursuit of salmon provides thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions in yearly revenue. So how did the industry fare over the summer season of 2017? We'll ask and take your questions today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Salmon are a big part of Alaska's identity, from the big hauls by trollers, set netters, and purse seine operations, to remote fly-in hotspots, to urban fishing in downtown Anchorage. There's a lot of opportunity to fill your freezer, and for some, their bank accounts. Today, we're going to discuss the good and bad of this summer season, and we'll take your calls. If you're a subsistence fisher, were you able to lay in enough fillets for winter? If you are a commercial operator, how was your season? And if you're a sport fishing fan with an epic story, call us. We want to hear from you. The numbers statewide are 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. And you can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be joined later by John Jensen, the chairman of the Board of Fisheries, and then also by Sue Jeffrey, a former board member and a longtime commercial set netter. But first, let's drill down a bit in a couple of areas in the state and talk to reporters who have covered fisheries in Bristol Bay and the Yukon-Kuskokwim areas. Dave Benninger is the news director for station KDLG in Dillingham, and he and his crew host the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report 7 days a week through the season. Dave, hello.
Hey, good morning, Lori.
Thanks for being available. That 7-day-a-week gig sounds exhausting. So you're done with that now for the season, is that right?
We put that to bed now, but it is exhausting, but that's the pace Bristol Bay moves, and we're happy to keep up, and it was just a really exciting year out here. So hopefully some of our listeners will call in and share their stories too, but happy to give the rundown from our perspective of what went on out here this year.
That sounds fantastic. Thanks so much. Start off by telling us about the historic sockeye catch this summer.
Well, it's historic. There were some records set. It's not the biggest, but it was just unexpectedly big. It was supposed to be a little bit better than an average year by the forecast, but all told, and they haven't finished crunching all the numbers just yet, but the total run went past 56 million sockeye. That was way over the 41.5 million forecast, and the fishermen brought in at least 37.5 million. We think it might go up just a little bit from all the fall fishing that continued. So, and that was way over the 27.5 million forecast. So those both right there are the fourth biggest harvest and the fourth biggest total run in the Bay's storied history. So it was really exciting, and it was just an unexpectedly big year for everybody. And I think that was really good.
What about the processors who buy that commercial catch when the run ends up being much larger than the forecast? Was there enough capacity for this run?
There was not, and that's a perennial problem, but it was much more so because the run was so much bigger than expected. So just about every processor in the Bay ended up going on catch limits. Many people refer to it as being plugged up, and that's painful if you're a fisherman. It's painful if you're in the plant trying to get those fish processed as quick as you can, but I know there's hard feelings for a lot of fishermen when they don't get to put away as many as they want, but by the time the season was all said and done, I think most people had really good seasons despite the catch limits their processors put them on. So they were planning for much less. They always, can take some bit more, but the fish came in such an incredible peak this year. There were days where there were more than 3 million fish landed in a 24-hour period, and just the logistics of the bay gets pretty stuffed up with that. So it's exciting to see, but it's also it's frustrating for the fishermen, of course, to be told that they can only catch so much in a day.
And do fishermen then just have to sort of stop and wait? Do they come in, or do they stay out on the water and just wait for sort of an all clear that they can go back fishing? What happens when the processors get backed up like that?
Yeah, it's different for everybody. If they're a set netter, maybe they come in. If they're a drift fisherman, maybe they just go on anchor for a while for a tide or something. And on a smaller year where the escapement is trickier to manage for the state, they might be closed for those periods anyway while fish and game lets some fish get upriver. So it actually ends up providing fishermen something of a break, which some of them will quietly tell you is not a bad thing when they've been going for weeks on end of fishing really hard. So it's frustrating, but it gives them a little chance to catch up on some sleep and some gear maintenance, I think. And the processors do what they can as quick as they can to catch up themselves.
All right, Dave, anything else we should know about the season in Bristol Bay?
Well, the price was up, which was good. It last year was, I think, a 76 cents a pound base price, and there are bonuses for chilling and bleeding and floating your catch. So last year, I think some people walked home with close to $1.20 by the time all the postseason bonuses came in. But this year started off as a $1 base price for most people, and with those initial bonuses up to a quarter, it's about $1.25 a pound some people went home with. And Lori, there were boats that did 400,000 pounds plus of harvest this season. So you can figure that's a pretty good season for those guys. That's something most of them have not seen in their career. So that's really exciting. There were a lot of labor force issues on the shore side, which I think will be maybe one of the main issues that gets sorted out between now and next year. These processors rely a lot on the H-2B visa program, and they didn't get the labor from overseas that they usually hope for, and recruited heavily from the U.S. this year, targeting areas where there's high unemployment. And they just had a really tough season. The state's even looking into some OSHA allegations of workforce safety and condition violations and such. So there's going to be a big reckoning as to where the shoreside plants find their labor in the future. And I think they're going to lobby hard to get some more H-2B visa extensions or something fixed with that. And then we reported just a few weeks ago, I think it was on the 16th of August, that the Port Moeller plant for Peter Pan Seafoods just was devastated by a fire. And that's not Bristol Bay so much as it's the area in fishery out there, but that's just a huge loss to that area. And we hear indirectly that the company does plan to rebuild, but that ended the season for those fishermen out there this year, and that was pretty sad.
Yeah, that's that was a terrible story. Sorry to hear it. And going back to the H-2B visa program just for a second before I let you go, did the processors have luck? You said they were recruiting in areas of high unemployment in the U.S. Was that successful, or is that why they're desperately hoping to get more H-2B visas approved again?
I would say you could probably do a whole show on that one issue, because there's a lot of thinking involved on where this whole state, not just in Bristol Bay, but where they get all the working hands to run these plants. And some processors in Bristol Bay will tell you that they've recruited mostly from the U.S. forever, and they have a very good track record. But I think a lot of folks were caught with a lot of workers came up and found conditions, you're working 18 hours a day, it can be a little cold and wet in there, and breaks are hard to come by, and a lot of, you know, these young kids, they burnt out pretty quick and washed out and just quit or look to get fired or something, and that leaves these processing plants really shorthanded. And So some folks are going to say that they've been underpaying these positions for too long, and they need to improve the pay to recruit better folks from areas that, you know, from the U.S. And other folks are going to say that they need to lobby hard on the federal side to get more H-2B visas to bring a workforce up that that works out better for the industry.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave, for your insights and your hard work out there in Bristol Bay, out in Dillingham at KDLG. That was Dave Benninger, news director for KDLG in Dillingham. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about all things salmon today. We just heard from Bristol Bay, Dave Benninger in Bristol Bay, KDLG, giving us the rundown out there. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you're a commercial fisher, man or woman, or you have been out sport fishing or subsistence fishing this year, how was your summer season? 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. We're going to go now to the southwest part of Alaska and check in with Anna Rose MacArthur. Anna Rose is the news director for KYUK in Bethel. Hello, Anna Rose.
Hi, good morning, Lori.
Thanks so much for being on. Give us an overview of the season for the Kuskokwim.
Well, the salmon largely arrived late this summer. Some Kuskokwim tributaries also saw some of their largest red and chum runs on record. The silver run was also healthy, but the focus was really on the king run this year, which was low and really dictated fishing on the river. Early to mid-season numbers were indicating that this year's king salmon run could be the lowest ever recorded. That's not what happened, but that's what the numbers were indicating. And as a result, the Kuskokwim had what some referred to as the most restrictive fishing season ever. The state and federal government closed the river to gillnet fishing. There were two openings for gillnets allowed in June and then two in July until the river opened again late in July, July 27th. And then any king salmon caught with other gear, live release gear, had to be released alive to the water so it could make it upriver to spawn. And these low numbers really put managers in a tight spot. Some people said that with the numbers looking so low, every king salmon needed to remain in the river. Other people said that people needed to fish and people needed to continue subsistence culture and they needed the fish for food. And so some people said too many openings were allowed. Some people said too few. Once again, two in June, two in July. Fast forward, ultimately what happened is most tributaries that have escapement goals for king salmon, they did meet those goals, and managers will attribute that escapement to the restrictive fishing that occurred this summer. The runs for king salmon were still below historic averages, though, and biologists are working through the winter to look at their models again because many people want to know why the king salmon numbers from earlier in the season appeared too low to meet the escapement that the biologists later observed.
All right. Well, that you've laid out a lot of I think, the tension that we see between users of the resource in the state. Anna Rose, there was hope that a processor would be in your region, in the area this summer, but that didn't come about. What happened there?
There was a ship called the Accutane that was in Bristol Bay. The plan was for it to come up at the beginning of August, but the ship ran into very large financial troubles. It ended up not coming. The word didn't get to the Kuskokwim Bay area until a couple weeks prior to when it was supposed to arrive. And so that means for the second summer in a row, there was no silver salmon buying. And fishermen once again found out just a couple weeks prior to when the season was going to begin, which means a large amount of income has not been coming into that area, and fishermen say that they are struggling economically. There's a range of they could get between anywhere $6,000 to $20,000 per season for selling these fish, and now that income isn't there. And once again, they found out last minute that it wasn't going to be there.
And you mentioned people are struggling economically. What about the subsistence fishery? Are people getting the species that they want, or are they just kind of taking what they can get?
Well, Bethel ONC tribe surveys fish camps, and they've been doing this for about 15 years. And this year they looked at 80 fish camps in the Middle River, and they found through talking with fishermen and their families that by the end of the July, most had not harvested the amount of salmon that they had wanted to over the course of the summer. So about a third didn't harvest the amount of kings that they had wanted to get, and some families, though, said that they weren't targeting kings because they wanted to conserve the species. Most camps said that they got their fill of chum, and about half said they got their fill of red salmon. The survey stopped before the silvers arrived, but some families said that they would start leaning more heavily on the silvers because they weren't able to get the amount of salmon that they wanted to earlier in the season. And then many families also reported that they had shifted their expectations this year on how many salmon that they would get.
And Anna Rose, I want to back up just a bit to the issue with the Accutan not being able to buy silvers. How, and as you noted, that caused some economic hardship. How are that those types of restrictions affecting fishing practices for people out there?
Well, the restrictions on subsistence practices by not allowing gill nets in the water is changing just how and when people can fish. So people have become used to fishing hard at the beginning of June to get their fish dried and smoked before the summer rains and the flies come in July. But with only two gillnet openings in June, that just wasn't possible. And people became frustrated. Some people said that they lost their harvest or part of their harvest to rot because of the wet and to maggots. But then other people said that, hey, tribes in other areas of Alaska have learned to preserve fish in wet weather, so can the Kuskokwim. Many people were innovating and sharing tips with each other, like keep fans on the fish or hang them inside the house even, brining them with extra salt. So the closures have shifted the rhythm of the fishing season, when people go to fish camp, how fish is preserved. And these restrictions have been in place to different degrees since 2013, and there's actually been a discussion building on the Kuskokwim with the emphasis, heavy emphasis, on king salmon. The Bethel ONC tribe distributes fish caught in the Bethel test fishery that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game runs, and the tribe really struggled to give away fish that wasn't king salmon. Some people saying, if it's not a king, I don't want to eat it, and some elders are observing that the emphasis on kings only began in the last couple of generations. Nets got stronger, king salmon got smaller, and people living on the river are looking at this change of emphasizing so much on kings, but now not being able to target kings to that degree, and are talking about ways to adapt. And there's a lot of different feelings on if people should adapt and how that adaption should take place and what it's looking like today.
And Anna Rose, before I let you go, there's a tribal effort to gain more control over fishery management. You recently reported on this. Give us a little recap of that effort.
So 3 years ago, the 33 tribes along the Kuskokwim came together. They formed the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fisheries Commission, and that commission co-manages the river with the federal government's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the federal government will take over the river, like this summer, when a particular species is low, and then fishing can be restricted to just local subsistence users. And every year, the commission has grown in that co-management role. The meetings are closed to the media and to the public, but commissioners were telling me that this year, in its third year, was the first time that they really saw the feds and the tribes in a true co-management, making decisions together and equally. And the commission is also working with other groups to increase tribal involvement of the fishery in other ways by having the tribes collect the data that the managers use to look at in season to decide when openings will happen or will not happen, and for tribes to be able to see how many fish are being taken from the river by their village. And much frustration from tribes has come from how data is collected and what is collected. So now there's a shift towards having the tribe take over that responsibility.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Anna Rose. That was Anna Rose MacArthur, the news director for KYUK in Bethel, giving us a recap of the season out there in the Bethel, Kuskokwim, Yukon Delta area. If you're a subsistence fisherman or fisherwoman, were you able to lay in enough fillets for winter? Do you have enough fish to get you through? If you're a commercial operator, how was your season? And if you're a sport fishing fan with an epic story, give us a call. We want to hear from you how your season went, what went well, what didn't, and what management changes you might be lobbying the Fish Board to make in the future. Now let's hear from the man who chairs the Board of Fisheries. John Jensen was first appointed to the board in 2003 by then Governor Frank Murkowski. Mr. Jensen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Lori.
And I forgot to give out the numbers again. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. So, John Jensen, chair of the Board of Fisheries, I imagine your job is sort of like being an umpire. No matter what call you make, someone's not going to be thrilled. Is that true, or is it less contentious than that? Or is it more contentious?
It depends. It can be way more contentious, and I just came to the, you know, to keep myself level-headed. I just know I can't make everybody happy, and the decisions I make, I hopefully are all based on sound scientific information presented to us over the course of time, and the best. I just try to make the best decision possible. I don't try to be lopsided. I know I've been accused of that, and both ways. So it's contentious. There's sometimes when it's when you go through a meeting and you get done with the meeting and you don't hear too much from the public, and you seem like you've done a good job, and there's still people not happy with your decisions. But that's normal. It's people. People depend on our fish a lot in this state. It's part of the backbone of the state. So I totally understand any feelings of anger or disrespect or anything toward people who make the decisions.
Well, give us your take overall of the season for salmon this year, and then let's talk about what some of those conflicts are. But first, kind of give us your thought. You heard from Dave Benninger and Anna Rose. Tell us what you saw overall across the state.
I think overall across the state, we're pushing past the 200 million fish catch numbers for commercial catch. I think overall it's been a pretty productive year. I heard a little bit of the last person that spoke, the frustration they have up there as far as getting processors to make it up to that area. I don't think the Kuskokwim came in as expected this year. I think the Yukon did rather well for King Salmon and Chums both. I haven't followed this closely because I get pretty busy in the summer, but that's just sort of a recap off what I've talked to several of the fisheries managers and stuff about. Bristol Bay, of course, we all know that came in gangbusters as well as Area M. That was a good season. And Kodiak area has still got lots of pink still showing up, which is late from my understanding, but it's been a good year there as far as pinks go. Cook Inlet, I think, went over the early prediction was less than 1.3 million fish, but it went up over that. So they went into the Tier 2 management scheme, and they allowed a little bit more fishing time. And one of the things that created a lot of issues this summer was allowing a fishing time late in the season in the middle district and the upper district, which caught a lot of cohos because there was a lot of cohos present. And from my understanding, after talking to several different managers for that area, the fisheries managers, it's my understanding that they met or exceeded all the escapement goals in that area, with the exception of king salmon. So cohos and sockeyes came in well. I'm not exactly sure about the little susitna at this time, but they predicted that it would make it, and that's one of the more contentious areas because it's, you know, it's a population-based center for fishing efforts. So, but other than that, and going down the coast, I think Prince William Sound was rather good. I don't know if they met all their expectations on natural run pinks, but I think they got the hatchery turns were good. In the southeast, the northern, it's divided up into spots. Petersburg sort of geographically the center, and the northern district may have met their escape, their early run predictions within the range anyway, and the as far as catch. And then the southern part, I think, was real short. I don't know how much, but I know it came in short. The same season's pretty much wound down here now after this last opening. Hatchery fish were good in southeast. The gillnetters did really well on chums as well as some seiners. And so the hatchery runs materialized fairly good, and as we all know, that the king salmon, the second part of the king salmon summer king salmon season was closed, as well as sport fishing and subsistence fishing, because of all the signs that we're seeing for our run strengths and what's going on. Looking into the future, it doesn't look very good. We're probably, I don't know how many systems didn't meet their escapement goals, but it was quite a few. I know in the fall, the first meeting we have every fall is called the work session, and at the work session, it'll come out that the prediction was maybe up to seven king salmon systems will be designated as stocks of concern, which means they haven't met their escapement goal for five years consecutively. So that's not a really good sign, and that's why the shutdown, because of there would be 30,000 fish on the table for that last portion of the king salmon opening, and that's what the commercial fishermen and sport fishermen and subsistence fishermen gave up as a shot at that. There, from my understanding, there's a good possibility there'll be a winter troll, and you know, sport fishing will open back up as well as subsistence. Probably around October 10th. I don't know what the limits will be on that. I just, from what I hear, it's a good possibility that they'll have a winter season of some kind for the trollers in, you know, southeast Alaska. So well, that's the basics that I have in my mind.
All right. Well, thanks for that overview. I want to talk a little bit about how decisions are made and the science that goes into that. We heard about concern in the Bristol Bay region over the record numbers of reds and chums, and then the low abundance of kings. That you've been talking a little bit about that. So let's delve into some science, but we're going to quickly take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Fisheries Board Chairman John Jensen. A former board member will also join us. Sue Jeffrey will be joining us later in the program as well. And we will take your calls and questions as Talk of Alaska on Salmon continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing salmon in the summer season for both commercial and sport and subsistence users of this amazing resource that we have here in Alaska, and it's the iconic representation of the state in many people's minds. We have John Jensen, the chairman of the Fisheries Board, on the line with us. Sue Jeffrey, a former board member and a commercial set netter, will also be joining us. You can also join our conversation if you have questions or comments. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255 or 478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. John, talk a little about the decision-making process for the board. Where and who do you gather information from to decide on allocation issues? As we heard from Anna Rose at KYUK in Bethel, she said that biologists are going to be examining their models over the winter to see why forecasts were not more accurate. What happens when you get these forecasts of a certain size and they're either much higher or much lower? How does that kind of shape the confidence going forward, and then how are adjustments made?
Oh yeah, well, as far as our information gathering process, we depend a lot on the Department of Fish and Game, you know, both sport and commercial fish, as their research, and whatever other information from other, verified research bodies. One of the most important factors is local advisory boards and the public input. Public input is really important, and that's this whole process was designed by our founding fathers of the state, which is probably the best process in the United States, if not everywhere. The people's input has a lot to do with how the state fisheries are managed. So everybody's got a little bit of into it, but the unfortunate factor, the way it was set up, I don't know if it's unfortunate, is that the Board of Fish members, the seven people appointed by the governor and approved by the legislature, they have the daunting task of actually making the final decisions on allocation and fish uses for both sport, commercial, and subsistence. So it comes down to the people sitting on the board that end up having to make the final decision. But I put a lot of emphasis in the public information I get from people, as well as the local advisory boards, because they live in the area the fish are in, and they spend more time at it than anybody else. They're there every day, all when they're fishing, and they see things that even the best research scientists can miss.
And John, there's a lot of layers with regulatory oversight, as you well know. There's state, there's federal, there's tribal. Anna Rose at KYUK was talking about tribal fisheries and co-management with feds, how they are working out these agreements. How do you see that meshing with the work that you do at the Fisheries Board?
It all meshes. I think the overall picture is that, from my understanding, is the federal government lets us manage the fisheries under their careful scrutiny. Basically, we're doing it for them. They take active management in some things. They've done that in several different things, like the Kuskokwim. They've taken some of the management over and then under various sport fishing, say steelhead in Southeast Alaska. They managed some of that. And then tribal. That's another part of the real part, important part of the process, is those folks live off the fish that are coming back, so it's most important to them. It's all little pieces, and just like you said, there's layers upon layers. And I was involved a little bit in the Kuskokwim meetings. I filled in for one guy at the very end there, up in Bethel. We went to a meeting there, and I understand fully what they're going through. I try to, anyway. I mean, not being able to king salmon fish down here is probably not as big a issue as it is up there, but you can feel it down here. It's the first time king salmon sport fishing or subsistence fishing has been closed,
mm-hmm.
as far as I can remember back. So I've never remembered a closure on that fish for Southeast.
And John, the conflicts between the user groups kind of ebb and flow across the state based on abundance and other things. Where currently are the tension points between various users of salmon in Alaska? Where are you seeing the conflicts currently?
Well, I know if I say this, it's going to probably be inflammatory to some people. But the biggest problem is the biggest conflict is the Upper Cook Inlet area. We've had commercial fishermen that have been there for 110 years, and we got are the state's biggest population who all have the rights to use those fish. So the conflicts come in when we make decisions on how to allocate those fish. And then to top it all off, there's all sorts of biological issues up there, too. The coal run's been really spotty. Coals are notoriously a hard fish to predict. On one hand, we got the Kenai and Skewelap River that have been over-escaping for years, sometimes a little bit and sometimes a lot, and you try to keep that down to a certain level. So in order to do that, you have to harvest fish, and at the same time, you're intercepting fish going up to Upper Cook Inlet, for that area up there that really depends heavily on sport fishing industry, as well as Kenai and Skewelap system along there. But up in the upper end, the Susitna and Little Sioux and all those river systems up there, it's a huge dependence for the population of Alaska go there for their recreational uses and subsistence uses.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go to the phones for just a moment. We have a caller in Kodiak. Don is in Kodiak. Hi, Don.
Hi, John. This is Don Parks from Kodiak. I have some questions on the APR put in by the United Cook Inlet. I read it and it's really confusing. I don't know if not well written and stuff, but I don't think they meet the criteria for a vintage change request. There's no biological reason. There's really no new information there. We have no past. I'd like to hear what you have to say on it.
John, were you able to hear him?
Yeah, he was pretty broken up. It was something about an ACR. Hi, Don. How are you doing up there? It's one of the ACRs we got. I have not had time to sit down and go through all the... I haven't got the staff comments on these ACRs yet. I've got the ACRs and read through them, and I haven't determined if they meet the criteria or not. That's up to the board when we have our work session, which is October 16th in Anchorage. So we'll make a determination on all 20 of the agenda change requests we received.
What does that mean for folks who aren't familiar with fishery board language? What's meant by an ACR and what kind of work does that represent?
The agenda change request is taking something up out of cycle. Although one of the agenda change request specifically is for Southeast, which is in cycle this year, but it's a proposal that didn't get put in time because of lack of data. But it's agenda change request is something unforeseen or something that is not allocative, generally speaking, but it's something that's just been missed. It's going to prohibit you from fishing a resource that's available in the future, or it's an unforeseen event that needs to be corrected out of cycle.
Okay. Thank you for that. We're going to take one more call, and then we want to bring Sue Jeffrey on the line also with us. She's a former board member and is a commercial set netter in Kodiak. But right now, let's go to Robert in Cordova. Hi, Robert.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Did you have a question or a comment?
No. Well, I'm just calling to... I'm a retired fishing game biologist for 34 years. And I was calling to thank John Jensen for his time and efforts. It's the most thankless job in the world. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you, Robert. Sounds like Robert was pretty emotional about that, John. Any
response? Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that.
Tell us a little bit about what goes into that decision-making process for the board. Robert sounded like he was reflecting a sentiment that it must be pretty arduous and difficult. Describe what goes into it, how you gather information, and how you make these decisions that really affect a lot of people's lives.
It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I was involved in commercial fisheries I still am in a small part, but I made my living off it for 45 years, and I thought it'd be a good thing if I put something back into it. I didn't realize how tough it would really be making these decisions that affect people's lives directly. And you take all the information that you get from the public and the industry and the biologists, and you just try to make a decision that's going to keep the fish sustainable for future generations. That's the whole mantra of our existence, is to make sure our grandkids have the same opportunities we do now.
Mm-hmm. How has that work changed in the 14 years that you've been on the board?
It hasn't changed. The basic work hasn't changed. My level of understanding's changed a lot from when I first got on. I was, all pro commercial fishing, and I still am pro commercial fishing, but I'm also pro sport fishing and pro subsistence fishing. It's changed by the length of time I've been on there. Is my perspective of how this is, how the whole system's supposed to work, and I really appreciate the governor giving me another shot at it this year, and I'm adding something to the board. It's my heartfelt desire to make the right decision and make everybody happy, but I know I can't do that. But the main thing behind everything is to keep our fisheries sustainable, and we still have glitches in the fisheries and unpredictable things like the blob out in the ocean last couple of years, and global warming or climate change, whatever you want to call it, that's probably definitely lending to a lot of the issues. We have more pinks and chums showing up on Norton Sound area and up along that coast there than have in the last couple of decades, and it's just it's amazing to see what climate change does to these fish.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska. We're discussing salmon. We have John Jensen on, the Fish Board Chairman, and we're also going to be joined here by Sue Jeffrey. Our number, if you'd like to join the program, if you have questions or comments, is 1-800-478-8255. That's the statewide number, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Sue, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Or we can. Yep.
Okay, great.
You're on. You're on with us. John Jensen is also here. The two of you were on the Fish Board together. Sue, first of all, tell us a little bit about how your setnik season was this year, and where did you fish?
Okay. I'll go to that, and I would like to also add a couple things regarding Board of Fish process. So, first of all, I would say overall, like the rest of Kodiak and really the region that includes Chignik and South Peninsula, the pink salmon run has been strong. It's wild pink salmon. Our hatchery stock is not showing up, but the wild pink salmon, as John just said, is really strong. I do fish. My husband and I have a sit-net site. We've been there for a little bit over 30 years, and we primarily do fish pinks. So that the good news is that it's strong. The bad news, just like a typical fisherman, you could always be better. The fish winds were not favorable for us. And then when they did turn to the direction that usually brings in fish, there was this kind of a phenomenal occurrence of what we in the bay, Uganic Bay actually, got on our nets once the peak of the run and the winds turned favorably. We got this slime on our nets. That was the only way I could describe it, or mud. We called it mud. We called it slime. We called it goo. And so we scraped up, not scraped, we just globbed up some into some formalin and took it to the local biologist here at Fish and Game that studies such things. And she determined that it was a phytoplankton bloom, and it just consisted. It just forms as what she called a colonial green algae, and what we call just globs of just goo. Well, it's kind of a dirt brown stuff that just, you know, slimes our nets, and so we can't catch fish. But it ends up being that it's a good thing overall because it's created by the just what John is talking about, water temperature changes and all that, and it's actually what gives us the nutrient-rich waters that around Kodiak and that, you know, feeds the fish and the whales and the like. So that was there are some good and bads, but we're still fishing because as others have said, the pinks are, I guess John said, the pinks are still coming in, they're dwindling, but the silver seem, they're always up and down, they're unpredictable, but some years they're there, some years they aren't, and I think I've talked to many fishing biologists when I was on the board, and they said that's just how it is. They're very hard to anticipate what is creating a good coho run, and so, but there are some showing up here, and the reds were good and healthy escapements here too. So
the goo that you found on your net was kind of troubling as somebody who's trying to catch fish, but it may have been an okay situation for the fish stocks themselves.
Actually, yes, that's right. I mean, like I kind of tongue in cheek. I mean, we like to complain, and yes, it wasn't good for us, especially at the peak of our season. But yes, overall, it's great, and that's what. Kodiak is kind of known for its fisheries. We're, you know, one of the top three fishing ports in the nation consistently, and we have this, you know, these upwellings of nutrients around here, and it's what feeds, you know, halibut and, you know, cod and pollock, and then our really strong salmon fisheries that feed, the largest brown bears in the world. So, So yes, it was unfortunate, but then when you hear the big picture, you can't complain.
All right. So I wanted to ask, while I have you both on the line, John Jensen and Sue Jeffrey, there was, both of you have discussed the pink salmon run. Give me some comparisons in the run from last year and this year for Southeast and Prince William Sound. How did the two compare?
Well, in Kodiak, we were at work. Well, we're going to run right over each other. We were
no, go ahead,
a disaster.
Go ahead, Sue.
In Kodiak and I think Prince William Sound and maybe Southeast too, we were declared a disaster because the pink salmon runs didn't show up. They were really large pink salmon. I remember they were like really, and almost the size of a Karluk red salmon, but the biologists thought, ooh, big pinks portend a small run, and indeed they were right. So it was just the complete opposite this year, luckily.
Well, I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, John Jensen, I'd like to get your thoughts on the pink run and also something that Sue said about the wild stock showed up but not the hatchery fish. And I'd like to find out if anything is known about why that was the case. We're talking about salmon today on Talk of Alaska, and we'll be back after this break.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation with questions or comments about the salmon season of 2017, the summer season. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We've got John Jensen, the chairman of the Fisheries Board. And also, we have Sue Jeffrey, who is a former board member and is a set netter in Kodiak. We were just talking about pink salmon. And John, you had mentioned earlier, or actually, I'm sorry, Sue, you had mentioned earlier that the wild stock showed up, the hatchery stock did not. John, what can you tell us about what's known, if anything, about why that was the case?
I think I referred to the Prince William Sound as far as hatchery goes. I'm not sure the reasoning behind that. I'm not sure if they met their natural stock predictions this year for Prince William Sound. I haven't checked in that close. We do have Prince William Sound on our on the Board of Fish agenda this year. That's one of the three areas we'll be dealing with: Southeast Prince William Sound and this coming work year. Far as Southeast goes, last year was just a terribly dismal season. The hatchery fish didn't come in as well as I thought they should have. As they were predicted, and the pink run fell way short, and the prices were down. Prices are a big indicator. Right now, this year, from what I understand, down here, the prices are quite a bit better than they were last year as far as pink prices go. I've heard all sorts of numbers. I won't repeat them because I don't know if they're true, but I just know generally that they're going to be a lot better, and the catches were better. I've heard of some fairly good catches for pinks in the southeast area, especially on the north side. South side, like I said, was very low this year.
Well, let's bring in a caller on the line. Pete is in Homer and has a comment about hatchery fish. Hi, Pete.
Good morning, Lori. Thanks so much for the program. My concern is, and I would like comments from your panel about the reports surrounding the controversy of massive new releases of, in particular, pink salmon, hatchery fish. We now understand that they may be, those massive numbers may be impacting feedstocks in the ocean, impacting the otherwise wild stocks there, certainly interbreeding. It's not yet completely determined just how they impact the wild run of pink salmon, but also others. And I would also add then the same is true of hatchery sockeye and their impact on the wild stock. Of course, those who depend on the catches are more than happy with the massively increased numbers. I would like to hear from your panel their thoughts about these reports of possible very negative impact from hatchery fish. And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you very much.
All right, Pete, thanks for the call. John, I'm hoping that you were able to hear him and would like you to respond as you see fit to this question that Pete had about concern over hatchery stocks impacting wild stocks.
I got that question, and I'm not really sure. I'm sure the more you produce, the harder it is for our natural stocks to find the food out in their grazing areas in the ocean or wherever they go to do that. I know we're not the only ones that have hatcheries. I don't know if our fish intermingle with the Russian hatcheries, or especially pinks. I think pinks stay near shore, so they probably don't intermingle out in the ocean for feeding. But I'm not 100% sure on that either, but just what I've been recall being told. I'm not so sure it doesn't have an impact, but I don't know what the magnitude of the impact is. And I know that that's a question that comes up a lot, and it's one of the questions that I don't know the answer to 100%. I would delve into it a little bit more and try to find that out if somebody wanted me to. I could ask those questions at the meetings.
Well, and Sue, you're on the line. You fish pink salmon, and you were saying earlier that the wild stocks had shown up, not the hatchery. What are your thoughts about the concern over perhaps, as Pete and Homer expressed, concern that maybe too many hatchery pinks are going into the system? What would you say to that?
Certainly, as John said, we did hear that concern, and I have read enough about salmon to understand the concern, you know, in the Northwest and the like, and various species of fish actually impacting other species of fish, particularly release of king salmon in British Columbia and Northwest United States. And so I do appreciate that. I think that the hatcheries done well are to, you know, kind of complement rather than compete. For example, if there's an area that, you know, we'd want to develop a sport fishery or complement a run of dogs or red or coho, then that's kind of a tool that's used. And I, when I use the word develop, I just want to point out that for the Board of Fish process, as John has said, our number one concern and mandate is to conserve Alaska's fisheries for the state of the people of Alaska for, you know, generations to come. But we also have the kind of a dual mission to develop Alaska's fisheries for the benefit of the people, the state of Alaska, because it is a natural resource that, you know, puts money into state coffers and, of course, local economies and creates jobs. So it is a challenge for the board to balance all of those concerns.
Well, thank you so much. We are out of time, but I really appreciate John Jensen, Fish Board Chairman, joining us. Also, Sue Jeffrey, former board member and set netter in Kodiak. We also heard from Dave Bettinger at KDLG and Anna Rose MacArthur. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.